Did you know that you can be a critically thinking, rational person and be a Christian? Did you know that there's good evidence that Christianity is true? Did you know that the Christian faith can withstand the toughest of scrutiny? Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we believe because of the brains God gave us and not in spite of them. I'm your host, Evan Minton. Welcome to Cerebral Faith Live. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you're watching this on audio later, welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast. I'm a little bit late doing the stream tonight because I had to go with my cousin and my dad to get a new phone because his had broke today. His just completely stopped working. It wouldn't hold a charge. It was almost completely out of battery, so he had to go there. He had to go to Spectrum and get a new phone, get a new plan and all that. I got one for myself because I just happened to be there. I was thinking of getting a new phone anyway because mine has crap storage, like 16 gigabytes. I probably installed a total of 5 apps that didn't come with the phone, and that even that was a hassle. But all of that, and then I went, we went to Walmart because my cousin needed something from there, and that the whole process took a little over 2 hours, 2.5 hours longer than I expected. So sorry for being late. But today we're going to be talking about the New Testament, bringing the New Testament to life. Why should we believe what the New Testament says about Jesus, about what he did, his life, ministry, death, and resurrection, and also even why some of the New Testament books were written. The book is called Bringing the New Testament to Life, and the author is someone who's, I should have probably asked him how he pronounced his name before I went on. But again, I was frantic because I was late, so I forgot to ask. But he's here now, and your name is Philip
Cotrow.
Philip Cotrow.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's
I guess I should have thought to clear that up too before we got started. But don't worry, I'm used to it.
So it's good to have you on the podcast, Philip.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about your book, Bringing the New Testament to Life. First, like, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, it's kind of reflective of my own journey. So I think, like a lot of us, I grew up in a Christian household where you're basically taught the Bible and that's it. And you're never really taught to question it. And, it is what it is. It's like, this is the Bible. This is the Word of God. And these are the stories in the Bible. And that's it. And you never question it till you get out into the world. And then for the first time, you're exposed to things like, so for me, like one time at work, I had a coworker asking me questions like, well, how do you know the New Testament, was written? I mean, it's been translated so many times and, from Greek, and who knows what the original one said. And being young and naive and not knowing anything about, like, New Testament scholarship or Christian apologetics, I was like, duh, I don't know. And so I experienced challenges to my faith for the first time, for sure, through some trials and tribulations. And fortunately, I did discover New Testament scholarship and found out that a lot of the things that atheists and skeptics were telling me to try to challenge my faith were actually not true. For example, the classic myth is that the Nicene Council decided which books of the Bible to include and which ones to ban, and the Emperor Constantine was secretly behind it all, and it was the sinister, evil Christian bishops trying to protect their own power. And that all comes from the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code nonsense, which sadly was a best-selling book that a lot of people still think is historically accurate. So I actually started getting interested in Christian apologetics and found out there are good answers to these things. And in fact, a lot of the atheist challenges to Christianity are weak or non-existent or based on a lot of historical mistruths. I've always been a history buff. History was one of my favorite topics in school. It was one of the few courses in high school I always got A's in, as well as college. So My approach to history started, I've actually written one other book. It was, it started off as a study on the book of Exodus. And then I sort of got interested in the historical evidence for the Exodus. That one is called Bringing the Exodus to Life. I made some mistakes with that book. I actually embraced the early date for the Exodus, but now I think the late date is more likely. So that book is actually now out of print. There's a few copies of it left. I'm kind of just trying to sweep it under the rug. There's like five or six copies of it left. And,
dude, I've been there.
Yeah.
I published A Hellacious Doctrine Defending the Eternal Torment View of Hell. Then I became, right. Then I became an annihilationist, and then I had to rewrite a portion of the book.
So yeah, I
people know how that feels.
People have said to me, well, why don't you just write a second edition of that book and just, you know, rewrite a big part of it? And it's like, I could do that. It would take a lot of work, and it only sold like 100 copies anyway. So I'm like, yeah, why bother? We'll see. So I basically did want to move on to the New Testament because, I mean, that's really the core of Christianity anyway. I mean, that's the foundation of our faith. And, I mean, you know, the scholarship is not 100% on the Exodus. There are good, solid scholars that think a historical Exodus did happen, like James Hoffmeyer, Kenneth Kitchen, David Falk is starting to get famous on YouTube now. But the New Testament is not really historically under that much skepticism. Even atheist or agnostic scholars don't really doubt that there was a historical Jesus, that there was a historical Peter and Paul. And at least the basic outline is, but there is a lot of misinformation out there. I mentioned earlier the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code book. You know, there's Jesus mythicism, the idea that there was no historical Jesus, that he was made up, that he's an amalgamation of different pagan myths and religions. So I started out wanting to clear up things like that and, you know, answer a lot of skeptical objections. You know, like for me, there was a historical Jesus. And I mean, yes, I'm a Christian, so yes, I'm probably biased, but even if I were an atheist, I'd still believe in a historical Jesus because there's just, I mean, that's pretty much what the overwhelming consensus in New Testament scholarship is and the history of, you know, ancient Judea. I do think the evidence is compelling that he rose from the dead. I tried to make that case in the book. But then from there, I think there's a problem with the New Testament that started when it was first organized by St. Jerome in the Latin Vulgate, which was that the New Testament books in our traditional Bibles is out of order. And it got arranged very strangely because it starts off with the Gospels with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which most of us by now is pretty much well decided that Mark was the original first Gospel. And then from there, it's like Acts, and then it's Paul's epistles from longest to shortest. And then they weren't written in that order. And I discovered as I investigated the historical story behind each New Testament epistle, there's a story that unfolds. And it's really interesting, and especially when you compare it to the history of what was going on in the Roman Empire. So that really illuminates the New Testament books in a whole new way. And I think that that is an untold story that so many Christians need to hear. And so I guess really that's the twofold mission of the book. I want to clear up misconceptions about the history behind the New Testament. I want to make the case that there was a historical Jesus, get behind the birth of the Christian church, but also show the New Testament epistles and why they were written and what it tells us about, you know, the trials and tribulations of the early church. And what really struck me was how familiar it was. Like, you know, these kinds of false doctrines that Paul was opposed to, like, it's really not that different from what we're opposed to today. I mean, we have liberal Christianity or progressive Christianity or whatever you want to call it, the prosperity gospel. I mean, it, you know, it's almost like there's this old saying that the actors change, but the stage and the play remains the same over and over again. It's like history repeating itself over and over again. We're contending with the same kind of issues the early church contended with. So I would love people to see that and to basically just understand the New Testament a little better. I think Christians need to know the Bible better when it comes to history. And I, that's kind of a passion project of mine. So there's the book in a nutshell. There's my motives for writing it.
Yeah. The in part one is start off dealing with the historicity of the New Testament. You make a case for its reliability. You know, we know what the original manuscript said. You make a case for the resurrection of Jesus. With regards to that first thing you do with the examination of the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts, tell us about that. How do we know the New Testament we read today is what originally was written down? I get this objection a lot from Muslims and Mormons. I get it from a lot of atheists too, but they really run wild with that. We needed Joseph Smith, or we needed Muhammad, because the Bible got really distorted as it was copied so long. So God had to fix it. Apparently he wasn't good enough to preserve his own word.
So I got that objection a lot too. I remember, like I said, you grow up in a Christian household and then you go out into the world. And I remember when I was in college and I heard these objections for the first time, my dorm room buddies that lived next door to me were asking me, like, well, hasn't the Bible been translated over and over and over again? And we don't have any possible idea what the original said. And I was stumped. I didn't know what to say. So I am glad I had the opportunity to research that. So there was a really nasty persecution against the Christian church in about the year 300 AD. This was before Constantine and the Nicene Council. And it was from the Emperor Domitian. Or no, it was Diocletian. My bad. That was the mistake on my part. So Diocletian unleashed a persecution against the Christians that was basically empire-wide. So you have a lot of Christians' manuscripts being targeted by that. And, you know, his aim wasn't just to throw Christians, you know, in the lion's den and things like that. It was to try to abolish their holy books, their sacred text and writings. So a lot of the Christian manuscripts were destroyed from that time period. And so this is where you get the phrase Alexandrian scriptures. So in the city of Alexandria in ancient Egypt, there was a treasure trove, a scriptorium of preserved New Testament manuscripts. Like, I mean, we can't say for sure if it was the autographs, the original copies, but there were certainly a lot of very close to the original copies of the books of the New Testament. And these were targeted during the persecution, but they were hidden in like clay jars, and some of the early church bishops managed to hide them and successfully preserve them. So anything translated after 300 AD, so if we find a manuscript that's later than that, we refer to it as an Antioch scripture, because Lucian of Antioch was basically the first Christian bishop who started to try to translate and rebuild the New Testament. But if we do find Alexandrian scriptures, so any that are dated to before 300 AD, they typically are considered to be accurate. And so from about the late 1800s onwards, we found actually numerous versions of the Alexandrian text. We found I cover in the book the history behind each discovery, what's referred to as the Chester Beatty collection, the Martin Bodmer collection. The scriptorium in the great city of Alexandria, they actually uncovered the ruins of a trash heap where, when early bishops were making copies of the New Testament text, they were just throwing them away in a garbage heap. And those scraps were found. So a lot of different stories like that. Scraps of early versions of the New Testament manuscripts have been found. They are written in Koine Greek. They have been preserved and translated. The newest translations of the Bible, the New Testament, are based on those. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into what are called the textual variants. But basically, what we're finding is, yeah, the New Testament was pretty accurately preserved. The Christians actually did a great job of it. And so As far as like the absolute oldest, I mean, there's some controversy over, I believe it's P52, Papyrus 52, which is earliest copy found. It's a portion of John chapter 1. I believe it's a portion of John chapter 1. It dates to about, I mean, early estimates were 90 AD. Now it's more likely probably 110 or so. That's you know, within about 30 years. It's not too far after the original book was written. So far, you know, anyone who's examined the New Testament papyri, the Dead Sea Scrolls gets a lot of credit and is a lot more famous. And I'm not sure why that is, because the story behind the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls for the Old Testament text is like a very well-known story. And there's been a lot of volumes of books. The New Testament papyri were found almost in the same manner. And the light they're shedding on is there are no Christian doctrines that are under threat. We also see that from the earliest references to Christianity in Rome. So when Pliny the Younger, for example, is writing to the Emperor Trajan, we find the first historical reference to contemporary reference to Christians. And all we can piece together from that is, you know, they believed that Jesus was God. They sang to him as if he was God. They met every Sunday and they held communion. And I mean, so there really isn't any evidence of any severe changes in the Christian religion, the Christian belief, or the Christian text up until well into the second century.
Yeah, that's really impressive evidence. And by the way, in your book, you talk about the comparisons between the New Testament and its earliest manuscript versus, say, Josephus and Homer's mm-hmm. Iliad and Tacitus. Right. I've always been impressed by that, how the New Testament just outcompetes everything. What is the numbers there?
I know that I don't actually have like the charts that I've looked at right in front of me, but I know the New Testament wins by a landslide, but then I think second place is Homer's Iliad. So, and that's about a 400 year difference from the originals to the earliest copies we found. And I believe that was within the New Testament papyri discoveries as well. Early copies of the works of Homer were discovered amongst it might have been the Chester Beatty collection. Yeah, and that was one objection that I had heard a lot, was there's such a huge gap between the life of Christ and the earliest Christian writings that we can't really know for sure what the first Christian writings said or who Jesus really was or what he taught. But it turns out it's a poor comparison, because there's actually, in ancient history, it always works out that way. Like, we almost never have contemporary references to a historical figure from right at the time he lived. It's usually sometimes centuries after he lived before we find the earliest biographies. So, for example, the earliest biographies are of Alexander the Great from 400 years after he lived. Whereas with Jesus, you know, if he lived at about the window of 30 to 40 AD, and the earliest copy of the book of John we can find is, you know, 110 or so. You know, that sounds like a lot. It sounds like about an 80-year difference, but that's actually really short in the grand scheme of ancient history. And we also produce four different biographies of him as well. So we have Mark, which scholars generally agree is the earliest, was probably written about 60 AD. So that's about 30 within 30 years of the life of Christ. And even then, Mark is not the earliest Christian writing. So we have like 1 Corinthians and Galatians are within even less time than that, where Paul is mentioning, you know, that they believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, that they practice communion every single week because of it in honor of him, for example.
Yeah, and that Paul's writings are written like 20 years after the death of Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one thing that struck me, and maybe I'm getting ahead of you, because if you're going to ask me what do I think is some of the best evidence for the resurrection of Christ, I am struck by the fact that no matter how much, and I'm just trying to be as objective with the history as I can be, but I'm struck by the fact that, you know, such a short period of time, word traveled slowly in the ancient world. It's not like today where, you know, you can chat with someone instantaneously on the other side of the world. Modern people, maybe we have a problem of thinking the world was always like that. But I mean, word traveled really slowly in the ancient world. And it's just startling to me that there was already a population of Christians following Jesus's teachings within, like you said, 15 to 20 years in the church at Corinth, you know, which is not exactly close by to Jerusalem. I mean, it already traveled that far. And we do have a lot of historical references to a Christian population in Rome as well, which is just so far away from Jerusalem. It's just amazing to me. How did Christians who are willing to die for their beliefs end up spread that far away in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, I remember earlier today, Michael Icona said something like, you know, don't overstate the case for the resurrection. That was the what the little graph, the infograph there said. And he said, we shouldn't say things like, I can prove the resurrection of Jesus beyond a reasonable doubt, or the resurrection of Jesus is the best attested fact in history, because yeah. you'll end up damaging your credibility. I left a comment saying, he said, well, these things aren't true and they don't need to be. I said, well, you probably shouldn't say it's the best attested fact in history, because things like the Civil War and the World War One and World War Two are way better attested than anything from antiquity, because it's so recent. But I would say, yeah, you can say it's the best attested fact of ancient history and antiquity, and I think it is. I am more certain that Jesus rose from the dead than I'm certain that, say, you know, the Rubicon River crossing happened, or pick any random thing that's just taken for granted that happened in that same time period. I'm less certain that happened than I am that Jesus rose from the dead, because there's just like all of the facts that lead to the inference, whether it be, you know, the crucifixion, the empty tomb, the postmortem, every single one of them has at least five different arguments to get you to that conclusion. And all of the naturalistic theories fail. There's just, it's like having a security system with like 30 redundancies. So like, even if a skeptic were to knock down one argument for one of the facts, he'd still have like nine more to knock down before he could convince me I'm not justified in believing, say, that Jesus's tomb was empty.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know if you ever watch Neil deGrasse Tyson, Star Talk on YouTube, his YouTube podcast. I find it interesting because he had an episode where he was addressing the moon landing was fake conspiracy theories. And he said something very similar to what you said. Like, if you're going to say that, you know, the government faked the moon landing back then in the 1960s, like, there's so many things that you run into, like, why didn't the Soviets, who were spying on us at the time, find out and tell the world they staged the moon landing? You know, why didn't NASA, why did they fake all that paperwork, all the money they spent on rocket fuel, all of the technology and design, all the, you know, thousands of engineers that they hired to design and build the rocket ships, all the prep that went into it? And even the photos on the moon, like the lighting and the shadows are such that you couldn't possibly fake it. They didn't even have the technology to doctor pictures like this. So you have to jump through all these mental hoops and gymnastics to say, okay, well, the government, you know, took all this money and they fabricated all of this paperwork and, you know, all the rocket fuel they bought, they just bought it and didn't use it. And, you know, somehow it was kept from the Russians in this massive conspiracy, and you have to pile, you know, ad hoc explanations upon ad hoc explanations. isn't it easier to just say we went to the moon? I mean, wouldn't it have been easier to just go to the moon than to do all that? And, you know, I realized, you know, with that same line of thinking, it's kind of the same way with the resurrection. It's like, you know, what sort of hoops would the disciples have had to jump through to fabricate the resurrection of Christ? Like, I mean, did they slip Mickeys to the Roman soldiers? And then when the soldiers passed out, you know, they rolled the stone away. They stole the body of Jesus. They hid it. They did all of this, even though during the life of Christ, they didn't even understand what he said, what he meant when he said he was coming back.
And then they died for it. And they somehow got Paul in on it. They somehow got somebody who was persecuting
them. Yeah, and so when they fabricated the story, they didn't make themselves the discoverers of the tomb. They made women who were not considered worthy eyewitness accounts. Then they brought Paul, one of their greatest enemies, one of their biggest persecutors. If he found out that it was all fabricated, he would have, like, destroyed them completely from within. I mean, isn't it kind of just easier to admit that they did see Jesus alive after he was dead? And I realize that requires a big commitment, you know, philosophical commitment. Do you believe in miracles? But I mean, just me trying to be objective and look at the history as objectively as I can, that was something I kept running to over and over again. It's just easier to admit that they saw Jesus alive after he was crucified. You know, it's kind of like just admitting that we went to the moon.
Honestly, in order to account for Jesus's empty tomb, his appearances to his disciples, his appearance to Paul, his appearance to James, the skeptic has to put together multiple naturalistic theories in order to make it even semi-plausible. But the more naturalistic theories you put together, the more ad hoc it becomes. But also, some of these theories that didn't do so well by themselves alone, they still have those problems when they're, you know, megazorted with these other naturalistic theories, like the hallucination theory. Well, you still have multiple groups on multiple different occasions all seeing the same thing at the same time. Now, even if you think group hallucinations are possible, multiple times? Okay, maybe you have one group of people see, you know, Mary in the sky at Fatima, but every single day of the week with different people coming each and every time, that just doesn't happen.
And then another question you bring up. So I know when we make these kinds of arguments, skeptics like to bring up like Elvis sightings, like people who think Elvis is still alive and try to use that as a comparison. The difference is people who think they saw Elvis alive are not willing to die for it. Like if you actually threaten them with imprisonment and death, they would probably say, okay, I didn't see Elvis after all. and I might say the same thing with like UFOs and things like that. It just, you know, it's the plain fact that people were willing to die for it. They were so convinced that they saw it. And another angle I took in the book too, and this was another thing that bothered me, because like I said, I think we should subject our beliefs to scrutiny. I think we should only believe things that do survive attempts to be scrutinized. But I noticed that no matter how much scrutiny I tried to throw at the resurrection as a historical event, I couldn't, there was still just stuff that didn't add up to me from a skeptical standpoint. Like Jesus wasn't the only Messiah claimant back then. I mean, and there were definitely a whole class of apocalyptic preachers in early first century Judea. John the Baptist being one, of course, but there was also one named Honi the Circle Maker. And then in the years following Jesus, there were definitely more people who claimed to be the Messiah. There was Simon Bar Kokhba. There was Moses of Crete. There was, and many of them had bigger followings in their lifetimes than Jesus did. I mean, they claimed that they were the Messiah, and they tried to do what the Jewish idea of the Messiah was going to be. They tried to lead a military uprising against Rome. But every single one of those men died, and after they died, their movements fizzled out, and they just became forgotten footnotes of history. And you see that happening over and over and over again. And yet Christianity, immediately after within the death of Christ, becomes a religion as far as spread as Rome. Like, yeah, what's happening here? And then, like, within the next 100 years, it's the largest religion in Rome. And now today it's the world's largest religion. It just kept growing and growing and growing and growing. Like, it's just still hard for me to explain that from a skeptical standpoint.
Yeah, that was a point I made in my video series too, that I didn't make in my book on the resurrection, but I included it in that Jesus is the only Messiah to actually get off the ground. And I always think of that that famous quote from N.T. Wright. He said, when your favorite Messiah got himself crucified, you either went home or you got yourself a new Messiah.
Yeah.
The Christians didn't do that. And they're the only ones who did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to wonder, like, why didn't this happen? Something had to happen that made them think, oh, this guy is not like those other messiahs that got crucified. This
right.
And right. I think they saw him. You have to at least say they thought he saw him.
Right.
So it's a good argument for the postmortem appearances, I think. But I think the skeptic has his work cut out for him when it comes to explaining all those appearances.
Yeah.
Naturally. The empty tomb is easier to explain than the appearances, because you could always say, well, maybe somebody stole the body, or maybe a dog got in and kind of hauled it off and ate it. a tomb is easy to explain away, but, you know, multiple different people on multiple different occasions seeing a man who was previously dead, that's not quite so easy to explain.
Yeah.
So, although the evidence for Jesus' resurrection is compelling, everything Jesus said and did was supposed to be in fulfillment of the Old Testament. As a second Jew, a second temple Jew would call it, the law and the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Old Testament say the Messiah would do? And did Jesus actually do all those things?
So, and that's a big part of the book, and that's something I really delved into, because we're not just trying to answer objections to Christ from atheists. We're also trying to answer objections from Jews who don't accept Christ as the Messiah. And I'm going to admit, I didn't think this up originally. I got this from Michael Heiser's book, The Unseen Realm. So I'll give credit where credit is due. So through major characters in the Old Testament, we kind of see a fragmented picture of the Messiah occur. So there's elements of what Jesus did in his ministry found in Adam, Jacob, Moses, and David. For example, all of those men are considered sons of God. Adam was a ruler and king over the Garden of Eden. He was a servant. He suffered from sin. He was exiled, but he lived on through his descendants, which is resurrection contingent. Jacob as well was considered a son of God, favored among the nations, a servant, suffered for his sins, was exiled due to deceiving Esau, then lived on through the kingdom of Judea, which is, again, resurrection contingent. Moses was a son of God, a ruler over the Israelites, a servant. He suffered. He sinned by striking the rock. He was exiled and not allowed to enter the promised land, but he lived on through the law of Moses. Again, resurrection contingent. David was a son of God, a ruler and a king, a servant who suffered. Those are the effects of his sin with Bathsheba. He was exiled after being anointed king. After he was anointed king, he was exiled because he was pursued by Saul. But then he still lives on through his own lineage, and Jesus is the eternal continuation of the Davidic dynasty. So you see, there's a picture of who the Messiah is supposed to be that emerges in all of these figures. So the two most contested Old Testament prophecies are Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22. I definitely think... Now, I mean, I fall on the side that Isaiah 53 is about the suffering servant. It's a prophecy of Jesus. You know, he's going to be broken and whipped and beaten for our sins. But there's been a lot of counter material objecting to that, that Isaiah 53 is actually referring to the nation of Israel. So I do address in my book why I don't think that could apply to the nation of Israel. It has to refer to a single person, a character in time. Same with the 22nd Psalm. Now, with that one, you can see why David, because David often wrote Psalms meditating on suffering. So you can definitely see why he would write those things about being conquered by his enemies. You know, he says, they pierced my hands and my feet. There's some controversy over what does pierced mean. Does it mean ran through, or does it mean like a lion, they were at my hands and feet? I argue that it doesn't matter either way. But one part of Psalm, the 22nd Psalm, that stands out to me is when David writes, my heart shall melt like wax. If you read the details of the crucifixion, you do see medical accurate details that I don't think would have been fabricated by the disciples, because they didn't have much knowledge of medical accuracy. But with what Jesus endured with his body, from the lack of sleep, the hunger, the thirst, the being beaten and whipped and flogged before the crucifixion even begins, he likely died of heart failure from fluid surrounding his heart. And that would also explain why when he was stabbed in the side, blood and water came out. And I think that in Psalm 22, when it says, my heart shall melt like wax, Jesus actually fulfilled that by dying of heart failure. But those are the two most famous passages, and those are also the most controversial. But there's a lot of other passages that I think get overlooked. For example, one very interesting Old Testament book to look at is Job, which Job 9:8 refers to Yahweh. I mean, it's referring to God as the one who treads upon the waves. Now, if you read later in Job, at the end of the book, in chapter 41, God is describing the Leviathan. Spoiler alert, the Leviathan is not the Loch Ness Monster or a fire-breathing dragon or a, an actual living dinosaur sea monster. It was this... The most terrifying idol that was imaginable, this giant dragon that guarded the edges of the sea, was the god of the seas. And in most ancient cultures like Ugarit or Canaan or whoever, they had a version of this fire-breathing dragon that guarded the edges of the world. And if you drifted too far out to sea, you could run into this terrifying monster. So this was like a god of chaos. You know, it was the Latanu, it was the Leviathan. In Egypt, it was the Apophis. So the Israelites, in writing the Old Testament, describe it as a creature that only Yahweh can tame. And so we see that, you know, he alone defeats the Leviathan. And I think that Jesus fulfilled that by walking on water in the New Testament. You know, that's a hearkening to him being associated with Yahweh. I also think that when he calms the raging storm, that is also a fulfillment. Book of Daniel describes Yahweh as the one who rides on the clouds. Well, if you know ancient Semitic culture, you know that the Babylonians described Marduk as the one who rides on the clouds. And the book of Daniel was replacing Marduk with Yahweh. So only Yahweh was associated with appearing and riding on the clouds.
Yeah, and Ugarit said that Baal was the one who rode on the clouds.
Right, precisely. I think that Jesus is actually a Moses figure in Mark 1, 9 through 11, when we read about his baptism. And remember, this is, since we're pretty much agreeing Mark is the earliest of the four Gospels, it's very interesting that in the original Greek, when God parts the heavens, and when Jesus is baptized, and the voice comes down and says, this is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. The word it uses is schizo, which is the same word in the Greek Septuagint that was used when Moses parts the waters at the Red Sea. You know, the waters parted, schizo, and the Israelites came across. So that's sort of like inaugurating or anointing Jesus to take up the mantle of Moses to lead the people, his people, to freedom. However, I think the most overlooked and maybe the most important Old Testament prophecy of the Messiah is in Haggai 2:7, which, you know, the temple, the second temple was built and the glory of God was not in it as strong as it had been in the first temple because the Ark of the Covenant was missing. But there's a prophecy from Haggai that says, I will come and I will fill the temple with my glory greater than there was ever before. So some sort of glory that was even greater than the Ark of the Covenant was coming. Well, if you don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, you have no way that that prophecy will ever be fulfilled, and it is a total lie because the temple's been destroyed, and nothing greater than the Ark of the Covenant ever did appear in that temple, unless Jesus was truly who he claimed to be. If he really was God incarnate in the flesh, and if he was the Messiah, he is the only possible candidate who could be a fulfillment of Haggai 2:7, that the glory of God would fill the temple greater than before. So when he appeared in Jerusalem and preached in the temple, you know, that was the glory of God greater than the Ark of the Covenant coming true.
Yeah. And by the way, for those of you listening, what he said reminded me that the Gospel of Mark has a high Christology. And last week, episode 132, it's also here on the YouTube channel. I did a presentation showing, going through in chronological order, chapter order, showing how Mark presents just as high a Christology as Jesus, but it's just not as evident because a lot of people don't have that Old Testament background. When Jesus says, I am the Son of Man, I will be seated at the right hand of God and coming on the clouds of heaven, they just think, oh, Jesus is just going to come back someday riding clouds like Goku.
Yeah.
And like the whole treading on the waves thing in Job, that's missed. There's also an interesting Greco-Roman argument there.
Mm-hmm.
But this also really sort of prophesies that the Messiah would be God, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, many skeptics try to argue that the new... Uh-oh, Alexa, stop. She wouldn't have gone off if I wasn't late. We would have been done by now.
Okay.
That's my fault. Okay. So many skeptics, they try to argue that the New Testament abuse Old Testament scriptures. They take these Old Testament verses, sort of proof texts, cherry pick them to sort of suit their needs to sort of prove that Jesus is the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And one example that's usually touted is Matthew's use of Hosea, where Hosea says, out of Egypt, I call my son. And the skeptic will, well, hey, Hosea is actually not even looking forward in time. He's looking backward in time, and he's talking about Israel and calling my son out of Egypt. That refers to the Exodus. And yet Matthew says it's about the future Messiah, and Jesus coming out of Egypt is in fulfillment of that.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond to, you know, some of these objections of New Testament proof texting?
So, I mean, for me, I think it sounds a little bit conspiratorial. I'm always careful, and this is me just trying to speak as a history buff, somebody who just loves to read about history of different topics. I never try to get into the head of the person writing the history and assume their motivations. I don't think it really matters as much as people think it does. So if you go back to the Old Testament prophets, did they actually know when they were writing this down that they were writing about Jesus? And his name would be Jesus, and he would be the Christ, and he would come at this date. They may or may not have. We really have no way of getting inside their head and knowing that for sure. I mean, we don't have a time machine. We can't go back in time and ask Malachi or Micah or whoever what they thought. Hey, who are you talking about? Are you talking about Israel in the past? And they may even say, yeah, I was talking about Israel in the past. But, you know, I guess it also gets into your definition of inspiration. I mean, you know, the Lord can work through people in different ways. And you know, if God can inspire Old Testament prophets to write down a certain text, it could have several meanings. Like, it could mean something to the people back then. It could be a symbolic allegory to the days of Israel escaping Egypt. But it could also have a double meaning to Christ in the future. I mean, you know, I don't really think God is limited to one interpretation or the other. So I kind of have a hard time with that about the New Testament authors specifically tampering with the text or misrepresenting the story of Christ to try to make it fit with Old Testament prophecies. Like I said, that just is a little bit conspiratorial for me. And I try to not believe in conspiracy theories as much as possible.
Yeah, the way I usually deal with, you know, some of these, I don't know how to account for all of them. Messianic prophecy is something I would love to devote intense study to someday. Maybe after I finish my Primeval History book, I can go into that. But things like Hosea, for example, it just seems to me that they're doing what, say, a modern preacher might do with the story of Abraham and Isaac. It's typology. It's like, I think Matthew knew it was about the past, but it was like what you said earlier. It's like Jesus is sort of the new Moses. And he said, hey, look, Jesus, what's happening to Jesus? And really, when you look at the story, it really is. I mean, what happened to Moses when he was a baby? There was an evil tyrant after him. His mother had to hide him because otherwise, you know, and because the Pharaoh was like, these Hebrews are going to rise up and they're going to take my throne.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened to Jesus. King Herod was after him. Mary had to take Jesus and flee.
And
so there are a lot of parallels with Moses. And I think Matthew, knowing the similarities between some of the things that were happening to Jesus, some of the things that happened to Moses, he sort of took Moses's life as sort of a typological prophecy, and the Exodus was like a typological prophecy of what was happening to Jesus. So like today we might, you know, a preacher might be behind the podium and he might be talking about, you know, Genesis 22 and Abraham sacrificing Isaac, and he would say, you know, this very spot where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, that is where Jesus was crucified thousands of years later. Abraham sacrificed his only son, and that brought blessings to the world. Well, God the Father sacrificed his only son on this spot. And so thus fulfilled the prophecy. You have not withheld my son, my only son, from me. I think that's what he's doing. And I think some of these can just be accounted for by realizing that not every prophecy is someday so-and-so will do such-and-such, but some prophecy is typological.
I agree with that. I think that's a pretty good way to put it. I mean, people have always looked back into history to try to make sense of the present. That's really nothing new. So just really human nature, really.
Yeah. So I kind of like for you to talk about Jesus's relations to the Jewish feast, which is also covered in chapter 3, because I found this section really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that was another thing. Actually, I'd written most of the book before I wrote that chapter, so that was one where I had done some research in this area and just got so excited. I'm like, well, I got to go back and add this somewhere. So, so as modern American Christians, we tend to overlook the Jewishness of Jesus, and there's a lot we can learn from studying the Jewish festivals. So in that part of the world, the harvest cycles were everything. I mean, basically every feast that they had, you know, you had the barley harvest, the wheat harvest, so on and so forth. So, the Jews had all these feasts that, coincided with the different harvest cycles, and, you know, they became these big religious to-dos. Like, I mean, people traveling from, it's almost wild to think about. You know, it's not something we do as much today. So you think about living in the ancient world and you struggle to survive and you can barely feed your family and you're on the verge of starvation. And yet every year, you know, on a certain date, you're going to pack up all your belongings and your family before the invention of cars and, you know, just get on some donkeys and ride hundreds of miles across the wilderness to Jerusalem, the city of your ancestry, to do this religious festival, just to turn around and go home. And then in a few months, you're going to do it all over again. It's really crazy stuff. But Jesus was very much a devout Jew. He definitely honored the Jewish covenants and all of the Jewish feasts. And one of the ones that I think is the most interesting is the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, which has a long and rich history where, so if you go back to the Exodus, right after it happened, when the Israelites crossed the Red Sea and got to the other side, the first thing they did was they set up camp in what the Bible calls Succoth. And so they built these temporary shelters out of palm fronds. And then in the book of Leviticus, it said you need to do this every year to remember what your ancestors went through. You need to reenact this every single year, you know, sort of like with Thanksgiving. You know, we dress up like pilgrims and Native Americans, and we try to reenact this whole a story that is like it connects us to the birth of our nation and to our ancestry and to the settlement of the Americas. So they were commanded to actually leave their homes, go out in the desert and build palm fronds and do this every year to observe and remember what the ancestors did. And that's one thing I really think is fascinating about the Jewish religion is like, there's so many rituals to remind them what their ancestors went through. I think modern Christians are kind of ignorant about Hanukkah. You know, we think of it as the Jewish version of Christmas that's less fun because they don't have presents or Christmas trees. They just spin the little dreidel and light the candles for 8 nights. But if you read the history behind Hanukkah, it's actually pretty amazing. It's a really fascinating story behind that. And so they have all these feasts and festivals. And, you know, if you pay close attention in the New Testament, Jesus does actually observe these festivals as well. I mean, Hanukkah is briefly mentioned in John 10:22. That's, you know, Jesus is actually going to observe that feast in that chapter. But with the Feast of Booths, the nation of Israel had neglected to do it. So throughout the years, they didn't observe the Feast of Tabernacles like they were commanded to. And so in after the second Exodus, you know, after the Persians allow the Israelites to return home from captivity, and the Jews start to rebuild Jerusalem, and they rebuild the temple, and the second temple period starts. There's a series of reforms under Nehemiah, and it specifically references the Feast of Booths, and it says that the people wept because they realized they had not kept this up like they were supposed to. And what was really interesting about that verse, this is really a good study to me. It's Nehemiah 8, verses 9, 10, and 14 through 17, for anybody that wants to write that down and research this. When they were grieving, you know, usually you'd expect there to be a call of repentance. But Nehemiah instead says to them, go out and start drinking and eating and partying and celebrating and being merry. You know, he doesn't tell them to get down and start fasting and sitting on piles of ashes under sackcloth and crying and, you know, begging God to forgive them. He just says, go out and start living up the ceremony like you're supposed to. So the Feast of Booths throughout the ages by Jesus's time has become like the most elaborate holiday in all of the Jewish calendar. And they have added all these extra ceremonies and rituals to this whole celebration. It's kind of like with us, it's like July the 4th. It's like, man, we light it up with fireworks. I mean, they had, so during the Feast of Booths, they would come to the temple and the priest would go through this whole ceremony where he would stand up and he would have a jar of wine and a jar of water. And he would actually pour them down the side of the wall and let them mix together on the way down. And that is actually, if you read carefully, that's where Jesus, before the crowd, said, I am the living waters. And so he used something that was actually going on to explain who he was to people. And later on, kind of like, you know, on July the 4th, we light up these fireworks at night. So there was this elaborate ceremony in the temple where the priest would ascend a high ladder up on high towers, and they would light these torches, these big, brilliant torches. And you could see, you know, it would light up the wilderness around Jerusalem for miles. And so the people would kind of gather and watch that, and they'd sort of ooh and awe at these big lights that were being lit. And that is actually where Jesus said, I am the light of the world. So, you know, he had a captive audience. He had a group of people who'd come to watch this. And then when he says that, you know, the Bible says the crowd was mixed on him. Like, some people were like, wow, that's interesting. And who is this guy? Others were like, this man has spoken blasphemies. How dare he say such a thing? So the crowd was divided and received him with mixed results.
Yeah, I really liked that section because I learned some things I didn't know before, which is always nice. Always nice to learn things that you didn't know before rather than just read stuff you've already known.
Yeah.
So the this is a big question. This is a big question, and so I'm only going to ask. Okay, you got like an entire section, like almost the entire second half of the book is dedicated to the question. Why was the New Testament written?
Yeah, well, that section ended up being a little bit longer than I expected. Yeah, so.
Yeah, but that was a really good section too, because it provided the context, especially since a lot of the books were epistles, and they're really one-sided conversations. But with epistles, it can really help to know who was being written to and what was going on at that time. What was the culture like? Even more so than say a gospel, but like. Why is it important that we know why such and such a book was written? You know, the Gospel of Mark, 1 Corinthians, you know, or what have you. Like, why is it important that we even know it?
Well, I really feel like the way that the church has interpreted a lot of the New Testament epistles is we're only seeing one side of a conversation. So we're reading Paul's letters in response to something, and we don't have historically the letter that was written to him with those questions. So I feel like we have a lot to learn by seeing what particular issues he was dealing with. And, you know, there's a lot of scriptures we quote from the New Testament, from the epistles that we take out of context because we don't realize, you know, who the apostles were writing to and what they were trying to say, what sort of message they were getting across. And I think for that reason, we get into a lot of misunderstanding of Paul's writings. You know, we've had the past century, there's been a lot of legalism. I know in my own history, theology, we got really bad about banishing women from cutting their hair or wearing makeup about 100 years ago. So you could tell Pentecostal women because they never had any makeup on. They had hair all the way down, and they only wore long dresses based on complete misunderstandings of what the writings of Paul were all about. There's definitely a real controversy going around about, can women be bishops? Can they be pastors? And I think that it's an overblown issue personally, but there are definitely women apostles, and there are some that were even employed by Paul who assisted Paul that he thanked later. And I think that, like in 1 Corinthians, for example, when Paul is referring to shut your women up or don't let them speak or let them keep quiet in the church, it's because those women in that church were doing these loud, attention-grabbing shrieks and cries that they had learned from their pagan neighbors. So Paul was telling them that this is a disruption. And somehow, like, people today have taken that as almost like law. It's like women are not allowed to speak in church. It's like, yeah, no, that's not what Paul was trying to say there. Yeah, there can be a lot of legalistic misunderstandings and misinterpretations from the New Testament, from the writings of Paul, from people not understanding fully the context or the full conversation that was going on. And I know probably some old-fashioned Christians are hearing me say this and saying, listen to that liberal heretic, that progressive Christian heretic.
Oh, yeah. Yes, join the club.
Yeah.
I've got like half a dozen issues that I could be tarred and feathered for.
Yeah, you know, actually, this is just as a side note. For me personally, the most controversial things I've ever said were attacking young earth creationism. Like, I haven't gotten too much controversy over the legalism stuff and misunderstanding Paul, but when I wrote a blog once that the behemoth and the Leviathan from Job 40 and 41 were not dinosaurs, man, they came after me for that one.
Yeah, that's probably, I think that would probably be not being a young Earth creationist, that's probably the worst thing. Other things can get people riled up too, but like,
yeah,
that's like, oh my gosh, you wanna start a fight?
Yeah,
that's how you start a fight. So, so to give your future readers a taste of what is to come. Why, for example, let's, you know, just pick like one book. I know you kind of got into this a little bit. Well, like, why, what was the purpose of, say, you know, one New Testament book? Why was that written? And I'll let you choose whichever one you want to talk about.
So, like, one that I think is interesting is Romans, because there's a real interesting history behind that with the Emperor Nero. So I sort of delve into the backdrop of the Great Fire of Rome, which broke out in 64 AD, how it burned through. Now, the historical misconception is that the Emperor Nero was playing his lyre on the roof while the city burned in the background. That's actually not true. That's part of just the legend that's emerged from that over time. He wasn't even in Rome at the time when it happened. Rome's sanitation was really, really poor. It was really overcrowded, and the living spaces were really cramped. And it was basically, there was a fire waiting to happen. It was a disaster waiting to happen. So when the city burned, the Emperor Nero, he actually could have been remembered as a hero, but when he helped with the reconstruction process and he was clearing away the debris from the fire, he then tried to build a temple to himself, praising himself for his great reconstruction efforts. So that's when the conspiracy theories started that he had actually been behind it, and it had been just this plan to destroy and kill all these people to build a monument to himself. That's when he began to blame the Christians for the fire. And I don't think Nero necessarily hated Christians, like, oh, I got a real grudge against these people, I got to get rid of these people. I think that they were just a convenient target in Rome. But you definitely see some of the most brutal early persecutions taking place then, when Nero was taking Christians and lighting them on fire and using their burning bodies on poles to light his gardens at night. And as a result, you see a lot of the Jewish Christian population leaving, because there was a high population of Jews in Rome. The first Christians, like the foundation of the Christian church in Rome, had been pretty much all Jewish. So a great portion of the Jews were leaving the Christian movement and going back to Judaism, because they're like, we can't handle this. This persecution is just too tough for us. This is hard. I didn't sign up for this kind of life. So I think the book of Romans from Paul is actually a plea for them to come back. And I actually maybe mixed up. I think I'm thinking of Hebrews, actually, now that I think about it.
It sounded like you were talking about Hebrews, because I like.
Yeah, I was talking about Hebrews. I said Romans all along, and I meant to say Hebrews. Because when I said Paul, I realized, wait a minute, I don't think Paul wrote Romans. Wait, I'm thinking of Hebrews, aren't I? So, yeah, Hebrews, I think, is a plea for the Jewish Christians to come back to Christianity. And the author probably remains anonymous because of the persecutions, because he doesn't want it to be traced back to him, because it's, you know, Christianity is illegal in Rome at that moment. So, but it's, that's why there's such an emphasis on, like, Jesus is the high priest, as Jesus is a fulfillment of the messianic prophecies, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, there's a fascinating history behind that. There is a fascinating history behind Romans as well. But yeah, I just that was just a big misspeak on my part.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that, because as I was listening, I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like Hebrews.
Yeah, it's late, man. It's been a long day.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, do you have a blog, YouTube channel, or and so on that you would like to plug?
Yeah. So I do have a blog. It's depthsofpentecost.com. I started it, I think, all the way back in 2015. I've been doing it almost every Saturday for that long. The blog was originally designed to be these, you know, fire and brimstone Pentecostal sermons. And originally, if you go back and read some of my earlier stuff, and I'm like, yeesh, I was a bit radical back then, wasn't I? But over the years, it's focused more on Christian apologetics and Bible studies. Those are the two things I write about the most, the kind of stuff we've been talking about tonight. I definitely write a lot about the New Testament. I have Bible lessons. Every now and then I'll write about current events or science or philosophy, because I'm just interested in those topics. Occasionally I like, because I love history, so occasionally I'll delve into weird history. I actually have a blog series on the history of the claim that aliens helped the Egyptians build the pyramids, which is a fascinating and bizarre history. But it's more fascinating and bizarre than the idea that aliens actually might have built the pyramids. I'm also on Twitter at Depths Pentecost. I'm on Facebook, just Philip Cotra. I'm about to start an author page with the book out now, but I haven't finished it yet. That's currently in progress. I do have a YouTube channel. I have not uploaded anything to it in about a year. I do have a bunch of videos. It's just me talking about stuff. I actually hate making videos. I'm not a good video maker. I'm not, I don't have the technical skills as a lot of you other guys do. So I make a YouTube video and it's like exhausting. And when I finally publish it, I'm just like done. And I hated doing that. So,
yeah, it is
there
if
anybody wants to go and look at it.
It is rather involved. I'd have to say, it's, like, it takes me like probably 20 hours to make a video, whereas back in the old days when all I did was run the Cerebral Faith blog, I'd just type it up, maybe it'd take me an hour, I find a picture to go with it, and then I uploaded it and it was done.
Yeah, that's why I'm still a blogger and never really branched off as much to some of the other venues. But I am on pretty much every social media platform except TikTok. I don't get that one at all. But
yeah, I went to YouTube because I saw like a lot of these other apologist YouTubers doing it, and I thought, you know, I could probably reach more people if I was on this platform, because it is a search engine and it's got an algorithm where things can show up, and so, yeah, I just decided to do it. I'm kind of hoping that some of these live streams will get me through until I can resubscribe for Storyblocks, because I don't think I'm going to do that other style I planned on doing, because it really didn't cut down on editing time like I thought, and it's less aesthetically pleasing. But I need to get to a financially comfortable place, because, you know, that Storyblocks subscription is a little expensive. Which, by the way, if you guys would like to help out with that, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/cerebralfaith. And speaking of patrons, before I leave, I want to give a shout out to my patrons, because one of the benefits is that you get your name on the podcast.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to David Shannon, Red Blade Flames, Steel Cat, Andrew Melnick, Nathan Hamilton, Jordan D. Hampton, Brandon Whitaker, and David Parrish. And if you'd like to be a Cerebral Faith patron, go to patreon.com/cerebralfaith. And if you want a copy of Philip Cottreau's book, all you have to do is go on amazon.com and just type in his name, or type in the title of his book. It is Bringing the New Testament to Life.
Yes, please do that. I don't have Patreon. If you want to support me financially, go buy a book, please.
Yeah, so all you have to do is just type the name of the book into Amazon. I pulled it up. It was the first result there. And it's $2.99 on Kindle. It's $14.99 on paperback. I'm a bit of a digital guy myself, so I got the Kindle edition. But the paperback is $14.99, and go pick up yourself a copy to read, to go in more depth about the stuff that Philip's been going through tonight. By the way, going forward, I am going to try to do these Cerebral Faith live streams on Saturday nights. I think that's going to be consistent because I don't usually, I ever since I got this second shift job at Dollar General, I have not had to work on Saturdays. Sundays, yes. Saturdays, not even once. So unless I have to cover somebody's shift and cancel, I think this is probably the safe date for me to start scheduling them. So, but I do recommend that you turn on notifications anyway. That's the best way to know when I'm going to be going live, unless I'm late. And you can also follow the Cerebral Faith Facebook page. I always post them as soon as they go up. And that's a good way to keep up with these live streams. And yeah, so we didn't have a live Q&A session. Probably I was too late and everybody thought I was canceled, but maybe next time. Anyway.
Bring it.
Yeah. Anyway, peace out. God bless, and keep using the brains that God gave you.